Track 12. Our second personality in the past lives feature is a rogue banker. Sir Robert Harvey was a Member of Parliament, social climber, speculator and embezzler, whose suicide was originally mistaken for murder, and he is Chris Armstrong's subject this month.
A mean sod who is afraid to risk his money bags by taking part in politics, though he wants to be a bar to gratify his petty vanity. The Journal of John Wodehouse, 1st Earl of Kimberley. Contrary to the opinion of the Earl of Kimberley, Robert Harvey was, in the general view, a generous public benefactor from a distinguished local family. No less than 8 of his ancestors had been Mayor of Norwich, and his father was perhaps the most distinguished of them all, having served with distinction in the Peninsular War, during which he was Wellington's liaison officer with the Portuguese army, retiring as a major general. But Harvey's generosity to the public was, perhaps, calculated to enhance his parliamentary prospects. Much was spent around Thetford, for which constituency he was subsequently elected. But the event which attracted most attention was held at his home, Crown Point, at Whittlingham. It was a fine day in September 1862 when thousands of the public, some arriving by special train, flocked to Harvey's estate to attend what was described as a military review. True, the mounted volunteers completed a few revolutions, but really the event was a giant jamboree. Huge marquees seated everyone for food and drink. There were horse races for the men, dancing for the ladies, Punch and Judy for the children, and bands playing all day. There was a giant, an 8'6" Frenchman called M. Brezé, and a dwarf, an aeronaut in a giant yellow hot air balloon, and to round off the day, a massive firework display. As night fell, people departed for home, grateful for a memorable day of fun. But not everyone felt this was just an act of generosity. A local parson, my great-grandfather, who had brought his daughter along for a treat, recorded in his diary his suspicion that the event had been the opening shot in a campaign to become an MP. He was right. Robert Harvey was not a man seeking parliamentary status to serve his constituents so much as to serve himself. He had one great ambition: to acquire an hereditary title. A knighthood was not enough for him. He aspired to be at least a baronet. He tried twice to gain the distinction by seeking patronage from the Earl of Kimberley and had been given short shrift. To him, the best remaining option seemed to be via Parliament, and he would spend what was needed to get there. The Harveys, with a background in the worsted business, had diversified into banking as early as 1792, originally as Harvey and Hudson, but later as Crown Bank, and Robert's pockets were deep. Although Harvey had 2 sibling brothers, neither seemed destined for a banking career. One suffered from ill health and was pensioned off with a £13,000 a year settlement, and the other suffered from mental illness and lived under the care of one John Mears, listed in White's Directory as 1854 as, quote, servant to the idiot. So Robert became in due course the sole proprietor of the bank, though later he took into partnership 2 members, father and son of another banking dynasty, the Kerrisons, into which family his grandfather had married. Kerrison Sr. had declined a partnership earlier, but perhaps in the hope of advancing the career of his son Roger, he accepted one. He was by all accounts just a sleeping partner, and sadly, he sleepwalked straight into bankruptcy. The London Gazette of September 2, 1870, listed the bankruptcy of both father and son when Crown Bank failed. Crown Bank had been a highly respected institution, with about 30 branches in the eastern counties and a splendid new head office in Norwich, built by the free-spending Robert Harvey at a cost of £30,000. Today we might call it a vanity project, but it seemed to symbolise the strength and solidity of the bank. Surely nothing could go wrong. It could. Saturday, July 16th, 1870 should have been a normal Saturday. In those days, the banks were open on Saturday, which was then the traditional day for employers to pay their staff. But any proprietor arriving at the bank to withdraw funds to pay his employees was in for a shock. Posted to the door was the following notice. In consequence of the lamentable catastrophe which has happened to Sir Robert Harvey, it has been determined by the other partners to suspend the business of the bank for the present. Rumour was rampant. At Catton Hall, the home of Samuel Gurney Buxton, later the first chairman of Barclays. Mrs. Buxton had the previous afternoon been holding a village missionary meeting on the lawn when Mr. Birbeck, like her husband, a partner at Gurney's bank, arrived bringing a rumour that Sir Robert Harvey had been shot by his son. A servant was promptly dispatched to Crown Point to check the story, but was turned away without getting any information, and it was not until 5 a.m. on the Saturday that any definite news was heard. When a messenger from Gurney's galloped up to the house during a violent thunderstorm to announce that Harvey has smashed, Mr. Buxton immediately set out to consult with his partners on what to do next. Crown Bank's failure was entirely attributable to the actions of Robert Harvey. It transpired that for more than 10 years he had been speculating on the stock market using funds from the bank. His practice had been to create fictitious accounts, placing depositors' money into those accounts as loans against non-existent securities, and remove the funds to invest. He had obviously covered his tracks well. Comment was made after the event as to the elaborate precautions taken by Sir Robert to prevent the younger Carrison partner, Roger, from discovering what was happening. One key aspect had been to require Roger to spend all week in the branches, only returning to the head office on Saturdays. Harvey might have got away with it for much longer, had it not been for the instability of the markets, as it became obvious that the war between France and Prussia was inevitable. Some commentators had suggested that Harvey had lost out by backing the wrong side in the Franco-Prussian War, but this seems improbable, as his crash actually predated the declaration of war. It seems more likely that jitters in the market were behind some of his brokers demanding to see the colour of Harvey's money to the tune of £200,000, about £24 million in today's money, and he couldn't provide it. He had obviously prepared for the possibility of discovery. Some months earlier he had purchased a pistol from a Norwich gunsmith, arranging for the weapon to be delivered to him secretly. As Mrs. Buxton held her missionary meeting that Friday afternoon, Mrs. Lambard, Harvey's sister-in-law, strolling in the grounds of Crown Point, discovered Harvey shot in the chest, lying under an ash tree. He was still alive and was carried into the house by some of the estate workers, using a plank as a makeshift stretcher. He lingered on for a day or so, and the rumours that his death was murder rather than suicide strengthened when it became known that 3 shots had been fired from the gun and he had apparently missed himself with 2 of them. But these rumours were soon quashed when the inquest, held in Harvey's morning room, established that when purchasing the weapon at the gunsmith shop, Harvey had taken 2 practice shots, thus explaining the empty chambers. Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of the whole affair is what happened afterwards. On the positive side, the bank was taken over by Gurney's, though at a heavy discount to its customers' deposits. In fact, so swift was the takeover that it was agreed before Harvey had died, for £42,000, half goodwill, half premises. Given all the troubles and travails of the banking business early in the 21st century, that it is a remarkable indication of how untrammeled the process of business was in the 19th. Probably the Gurneys were inspired not just by profit, but also by the need to shore up confidence in the financial system. But if the short-term consequences were easily dealt with, the longer ones were not. For more than 25 years after Harvey's suicide, there were investigations, court cases, disputes about the disposal of assets, and allegations of fraud. Most of them involved Harvey's solicitor, Isaac Bug Coakes. Born Isaac Bug, the son of the village carpenter in Brundall. He adopted the surname Cokes when his wife inherited from an uncle of that name. He was truly a local boy made good, qualifying as a solicitor and acquiring great wealth. But his methods were not always highly professional. Having negotiated the sale of the bank to Gurney's, some of his activities soon attracted attention. There were allegations of his buying some of Harvey's assets at discounted prices arranged by perpetrating a fraud in conjunction with others, double charging fees and other actions which aroused the interest of both the Law Society and the Commissioner in Bankruptcy. Evidently, it all became too much for the former. Cokes was eventually struck off the rolls for several cases of professional misconduct and one of gross misconduct. Perhaps Harvey and Cokes deserved each other as client and advisor. But Cokes, unlike Harvey, died a very rich man. A fuller version of the Harvey affair and his eventually successful pursuit of a baronetcy, together with a detailed account of Cokes's dishonesty, can be found in the author's book Mustard, Boots and Beer, Lark's Press, 2014.